Well, hello everyone. Today we have Bishop John Sherrington with us, our lead bishop for life issues here at the Catholic Bishops Conference of England and Wales. And it's an important topic we're talking about. It probably won't have escaped your attention that there's a bill passing through Parliament at the moment that seeks to legalise assisted suicide. Now, all our bishops have had plenty to say about that in opposition. The second reading and vote resulted in a vote of 330 MPs voting for and 275 voting against, so that bill has now passed to the committee stage that we're currently in, with a third reading and vote expected in April. So all is not lost is what we would certainly say to begin with, and it's a really good time for us to be speaking to Bishop John Sherrington about this. Bishop John, how are you?
Very well, thanks. I'm very pleased to be here, James.
Great to have you here. Now, I think that's an important point, isn't it? All is not lost at this stage. So maybe it's worth rewinding a little bit and just reminding people why we're opposed to this bill.
I agree with you totally. Everything is not lost and we must continue to fight this bill, especially for the third reading, which will be late April. To recall and to recap, I oppose this in principle, because life is sacred, life has dignity, and in that sense, this is assisting their suicide. It's helping another person to end this person's life. So in principle, I'm opposed to it, but there's many pragmatic reasons why, in fact, I would argue that the MP should vote against it. So one would be the fact that it will make people who are already vulnerable feel more vulnerable and perhaps fearful. It will put a burden into their lives. We know that the elderly, the sick, the dying often feel very vulnerable, they're very afraid. And now with this possibility that there'll be those pressurizing them or trying to be coercive in ending their life, this would be an added burden. There's also many disability rights groups who oppose this bill because they're concerned about the impact on those who are living and living very well with disability. So that first area is really freedom and coercion. A second area that's very important is it will change the relationship between a doctor and his or her patient. No longer will the doctor be one who cares, but rather now, moving from having a duty to care, the doctor will have a duty to kill if that's what's asked. And that completely changes the relationship with the medical profession. And it puts pressure on medical professionals, healthcare professionals at all levels to have to be able to deal with this. So coercion, pressure on others, the doctor-patient relationship would be important reasons to oppose this.
And of course, there are important points to be made about the level of scrutiny that this private member's bill has already been put under or not, wouldn't there? Because it's passed really, really quickly. And I think Cardinal Vincent Nichols, the president of the conference, even said, well, more attention has been given to the fox hunting debate when that happened than there has been to this literally, this life and death issue.
That's right, James. In fact, this is a private member's bill, and therefore it has a very restricted timescale in Parliament. Very little time has been given to it at the second reading and the time given for debate. The committee stage has also only been able to hear a certain number of views. So I would say that the bill should be opposed by MPs because of the lack of scrutiny, the lack of time that's been given to it. In fact, every MP has a duty to ensure that legislation in the country has sufficient scrutiny and sufficient time. And in this case, I would argue that's not the case. So even if an MP is for this particular issue, they could still vote against it on the basis of inadequate scrutiny.
And there's also that matter of safeguards that were promised with this bill. I think probably that one of the clearest ones would be that a judge would have to sign off on a request for an assisted death. That appears no longer to be the case, does it?
Again, that's very true. The promise of a judge to give a final scrutiny, which in a sense itself is complicated because judges would find this very difficult. after receiving medical opinions, what exactly is the evidence on which they're basing their judgment? How do they find that out? But the judge was promised as the final arbiter. Now we're told there won't be a judge. The legal profession is saying they won't have enough time and they won't have enough judges to do it. So there's talk of a panel of experts. But who makes up that panel of experts? Are they truly unbiased? Are they truly free? Or in fact, there's the danger that the panel of experts would already have a bias towards the person's view and acquiescing in that. So this is a great uncertainty, and this safeguard that we were promised very strongly has already been eroded.
And then in terms of delivering it anyway, you made very clear what our principled objection is to assisted suicide. But we have plenty of doctors, nurses, medical professionals across the board who are Catholics working in our National Health Service. Isn't the concern too that they may be feeling the pressure, a coercion of sorts, into actually complying with something that their faith and belief says that they shouldn't be complying with?
Yes, and many healthcare professionals at all levels in the NHS who are Catholics and would have very strong views about the dignity of human life from the very beginning to its very end and would not want to participate in this. Now, it's not clear whether they have freedom not to be engaged in this, particularly those who are working not at the level of doctors, but nurses, care assistants, those sort of people, those who visit those who are very ill and perhaps dying at home. So there's a question of safeguards for them. And, you know, it's said that if a doctor would have conscientious objection against this, but that's not being extended, as far as I can see, in the legislation to all the other healthcare professionals. And they don't have as strong a right or as strong as a position, really. They're often working in the midst of a team, and that would make it very difficult. So there is the concern about how this will force those who are opposed to assisted suicide into perhaps having to cooperate in some way.
And, you know, we look at the jewel in the crown quite often, don't we, when we look at the hospice movement, Catholic hospices, all hospices, and we talk about palliative care, that wonderful care at the end of life, care being the operative word. Now, there is some anxiety, isn't there, that a hospice might not be actually able to carry out its core mission of care if this goes through?
Certainly this raises many different questions. Firstly, we know that hospices are very poorly funded. They really rely on the funding that comes from voluntary donations. Therefore, they're already impoverished. And yet we need more palliative care and more hospice care to help people truly live in a good way through sickness and dying, particularly when it comes to that process of dying. So there's a concern about how this would shape and change hospice care. There's also the concern about, we know that people who are dying and have many different conditions, firstly, can experience great suffering. One of the great gifts of hospice care is that those areas of suffering are addressed. It may be psychological, it may be emotional, it may be spiritual suffering. Well, chaplains, pastoral carers can help people through that suffering. Often in hospices, there's great reconciliation towards the end of life with family members where there may have been estrangement. We'd lose all of that. That's the danger. And then in terms of pain control, which hospices manage very well, pain control has really improved in terms of what it can offer. And again, that is a way in which a person can be assisted. And I would not want to see the way in which pain or suffering is accompanied or controlled diminished in any way.
Well, I suppose if we were to use the phrase assisted dying, we would probably say that a lot of our teaching and a lot of people working in hospices do help people to die in a good way.
Yes, assisting. In a sense, this term has now become very politicised. Yeah. And assisted dying, as some of the proponents of this bill call it, is very much a euphemism, because it's in fact going to permit the suicide of another person. But the Catholic tradition has many safeguards and areas of reflection in terms of what we would call a good death. It's not necessary to strive officiously to preserve life at all costs. That's a very delicate medical judgment, and it involves the freedom of a person to decide what treatment they'll have or not. But certainly those principles are really important to ensure that this, we're recognizing death is part of life, but you cannot intend death, though you can alleviate symptoms and help people to be comfortable as they die.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think even as a Catholic who hadn't been into a hospice before, going into a hospice just to observe, perhaps not with the anxiety of a terminal diagnosis or all those things that would come from needing to use the hospice and all the services it offers, I completely didn't really understand, I don't think, what hospices offered, and the fact that you don't actually go there to die, maybe right at the very end, but 50% of people, perhaps with a year or less to live, to and fro a bit from the hospice. They get familiar with this caring environment. It feels very life-giving rather than just ebbing away, doesn't it?
Hospice care has changed dramatically over the last years and continues to change because of the improvements in pain control, because of the improvements in care and treatment. So there's in every hospice now a much greater number of people who participate in their outreach programs and receive various forms of care at home in different ways and learn to live with a terminal diagnosis. So whereas in the past a terminal diagnosis might have led to a very quick death, today people can receive a terminal diagnosis and live with it well for a year or more years. The state of being able to make a diagnosis has improved, as well as the management and control of particularly many, many forms of cancers. And so there's the outreach program supporting people, their families, their carers. And then, yes, at the very end, there may well be residency in a hospice or care at home with the help of a hospice. But we do need to recognise that our science of medicine in this area has completely changed and developed.
Now, just to bring you back a little bit to the sort of scope of this bill being extended, possibly even unintended or unknown consequences. You mentioned disability groups. You mentioned that the vulnerable, the elderly, may feel a burden potentially. But then I find myself concerned about those with mental health problems, anxiety, depression, you know, that many people have these days in this modern world of ours. I believe as well that in somewhere, you know, some of these jurisdictions where assisted suicide has been brought in, Canada being an obvious one, that we usually see an extension of the law to cover all manner of people, don't we? Is that a key anxiety of yours?
I'd be very anxious about that. Certainly, as we look around the world, whether we look at Europe with Belgium and its legislation, or we look at Canada, as you mentioned, or New Zealand, we see how initially the proponents of such a bill promise it will be controlled. And yet any law can always be amended. And we've seen how more and more medical conditions or psychological mental health issues become a focus for a change of law, and therefore the categories of who may be allowed to end their life expand, and therefore the slippery slope is travelled. So I'm very cautious about those who say this is so ring-fenced and safeguarded that it won't change, because experience shows us that it does change. And also already in the present debate, there are those arguing for a wider extension of this law than originally proposed.
Now, we will talk about the action, what people can do to actually make their voices heard, because as we've said before, it's not too late. We are ahead of a third reading. There are ways where you can contact your MP, and we will go on to that. But I wanted to ask you a little bit of a left field question, which is quite simply, I know you're a Catholic bishop and I know Catholic teaching, but where specifically does your passion for pro-life work come from?
are very interesting, James. I remember when I was about 7, my grandmother had a massive stroke and then lived with us. And in those days, the treatment for strokes was not as good as it is now. She had mobility, but she'd lost a lot of her speech, though her mind was very sharp. And of course, she'd become very frustrated in trying to express herself. And so as a child, I suppose I spent a lot of time with her, trying to help her to do that. And somehow those family relationships for all of us are so important. They shape who we become. So I suppose having grandparents who were sick and loving them made me want their lives to continue, want me to be with them and accompany them. And the idea of ending a life because of suffering is just incomprehensible when I think of them. And I see this grandmother was on her own. My other grandparents were together, but the way they managed each other's old age was lovely to see, and the love between them. So that must have begun some process of getting more concerned about the sacredness of life and the gift of life. I've always appreciated, particularly old people at the end of life, and wanting to see that they live their old age, their sickness as well as possible. I think having been to Lourdes a few times with pilgrimages, the Across Trust, and then the diocese working with people who were terminally ill or perhaps had disability, lived with disability, again made me value their lives as well as the gifts that I have. So all that shapes how we see life, and that's deepened then in the light of the gospel, and that the gift of life that God gives us through the book of Genesis and understanding the sacredness of life, and that Jesus shared in our human life fully. He shared fully in suffering on the cross, and he endured that out of love for us, in order then that he gave his life and the Father raised him from the dead. So in terms of those basic experiences, in terms then of what the scriptures tell us, the church teaches, the fact that God's given us this gift of life to be treasured, to be preserved, to be cared for, and that Jesus shared in it, teaches me a lot about life and death.
Joe, it's funny because I converted in my 30s, but I'd always class myself as having been pro-life, because I don't know about you, but it feels to me like it's a matter of faith, yes, but reason as well.
It's, reason about, and those many humanists are agreeing with us in opposing this bill. There are those that don't, but some will recognise the dignity of the person, the sacredness of the person, and that you cannot end the life of another person. It's a fundamental human boundary and protecting those who are most vulnerable and those who are weakest in our society. And all of us have a responsibility to protect them. And as I said at the beginning, I'm concerned about people feeling burdened, the coercion that can be put on others. And we do know that one of the most contentious areas of life are where the money goes, the wills that are made. And that, for some, may also be a concern.
Yeah, very good point. And it's quite interesting as we step forward on our Lenten journey towards Easter, that we have a sick Pope, don't we? We're praying for Pope Francis. And yet, talking about that dignity, talking about that value, probably talking about one of his words, accompaniment, we're able to be close to him and see his suffering, akin to a certain extent what we saw with Pope St. John Paul II.
That's very true. And at the moment, I think Pope Francis wants to be a witness to suffering and living with his medical conditions, but we see him making the most of each day, that he's phoning the parish community in Gaza, which is wonderful. He's loving and concerned for them, that he's still sending us messages of encouragement and the importance of loving and living with suffering. So he, as you say, St. John Paul II, are witnesses, and I think can give great encouragement to those who are sick or those who are dying at this time. So we pray for the Pope's health and his recovery, and we entrust him to God at this time. But a great witness and an example. And as he has thanked us for praying for him, it's a reminder to pray for him and all those who are dying.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we conclude this piece, we obviously looking at the bill, the third reading and vote, there's still time. So I presume we're advocating that keep your foot on the gas, contact your MP, make your voice heard, your opposition heard to those that will vote in the third reading. And there is that talk that there's some sort of 28 MPs potentially that would need to change their mind to make a difference in this vote. Would you still advocate that through the Right to Life website, people make their voices heard to their MPs?
I think it's really important that people write to their MPs. You may either write a letter, or you may use the cards that come from Right to Life. You may use the e-campaign. But we need to tell MPs of our concerns and why we're opposed to this bill. And I certainly would encourage everybody to do that. Bishops will be writing pastoral letters at the beginning of April, again to motivate and to mobilise people to write against this bill. An MP will look at his or her inbox, will look at the letters that are arriving and make the judgments based on them. So it's really important to contact your MP and to write to them. And the other point again that I've made, and this is really more for MPs, and you may mention this in your letters, they have a duty to give adequate scrutiny and time to every piece of legislation that affects people in our country. And this is one of the most profound changes in law that we're going to be experiencing if it passes. So the MPs need to know that they must take that responsibility and live that duty.
Very well said. And just a reminder of the URL for the e-campaign, in particular from Right to Life. It's righttolife.org.uk/asvote. Bishop John, thank you so much. Thank you for giving us a little bit of personal insight as well. Very much appreciated. And well, there is still time. Let's hope that assisted suicide does not make it onto the statute book. And we advocate for life as we always have done.
I'm certainly pleased to have been able to share that little bit of family history. And really, when you ask the question, it's amazing how the Holy Spirit prompts a response. But it's those narratives that are really important to communicate, because they teach us so much about life. And we've got all our reasons, we've got our arguments, but the use of the stories, the use of the experiences, especially from people who have perhaps nursed a sick member of the family to death, and those who have been present at that sacred moment, that needs to be shared, because it is significant and it's holy, and it's important for us to recognise that. So thank you very much, James.
Bishop John, thank you.